Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Scriptorium. This is your host, Douglas Bond. We're glad that you've tuned in, and we invite you to go down and click that follow button and share with other friends about the Scriptorium. Why on earth do we call it the Scriptorium? Well, because the Scriptorium saved civilization. Remember that it was in the Scriptorium of the Middle Ages, sometimes called the Dark Ages, where manuscripts were meticulously copied from the ancient world, classic poetry and literature. We're going to talk about that here in a moment. We have a show today about one of the great African-American poets of colonial America on this Martin Luther King commemorative day. How were those transmitted when there were no archives, there were no humidity-controlled museums? They were meticulously copied generation after generation after generation. How about the hymns of the early church? How about the early manuscripts, Hebrew and Greek, of the Bible preserved down through the centuries in scriptorium? Hence, we can say with confidence that the scriptorium saved civilization. Well, that's a pretty grandiose thing to live up to, but in the scriptorium, we want to feature heroes of church history. We'll do that today. As we talk about one of them, we want to talk about the literature and the poetry, the great classics of the past, and why it's important that Christians care about that and know great literature. And we'll talk about that literature today, in fact, and other things, interviews with other authors and important discussions with homeschool families and all, as we have done in the past. So we're very glad that you tuned in to the Scriptorium, and we invite you to stay tuned and to share the Scriptorium with others. Follow us at the button down below. Well, today is the commemorative day of Martin Luther King, Baptist pastor born January 15th, 1929. Yeah, really, he was the most visible voice of the civil rights movement, nonviolent civil rights. And we commend and commemorate his great work, the for bringing freedom to all in this country. We want to maintain that freedom in our current situation, as First Amendment rights are being encroached once again in different ways than they were then, as well as in some same ways. But what I want to talk about today, since so many podcasts and blog posts will be on Martin Luther King, I wanted to go back. Let's turn the clock back more than 250 years, back to 1753, Senegal, probably West Africa in any case. We don't know a lot about her early history. Phyllis Wheatley, born in 1753 or 54, nobody knows for sure, and kidnapped in tribal warfare and sold to slavers and put on a slave ship bound for Boston. There she was purchased by John as a little girl, probably 7 or 8 years old, to be a personal assistant to his wife, Susanna. She was named Wheatley for the family, and she was brought into that family and on all levels that could be understood in any possible way in the 18th century, she was treated as a family member. The first name was, in fact, the name doesn't tell the past of those elsewhere, and they were horrors, and the slave trade was a horrific evil. John Newton would become a Christian and continue to be a slave captain for two voyages, and finally become the great advocate of the ending of the voice. He would even testify. William Wilberforce would bring meant to testify this great Phyllis Wheatley, hers coming up in this broadcast on the Scriptorium here in a few moments, and she We can only use our imaginations about that. But the Wheatley family welcomed her in as a family member, educated her, taught her to read and write, even though eventually those would be illegal activities, sadly, in the 19th century, made so by legislation. Ended by legislation as well in our country. But she was obviously exposed to great literature. She was even taught the rudiments of Latin by the Wheatley's older daughter, and was even taken by their son with him to family business, where she was really quite a sensation, because by that time, the evidence of her poetic gift was made plain to her family and to others. Her poetry published while she was there in England in 1773. And they even had a preface, had to verify that this was by and by a woman, and by a black slave woman, in fact. Some of that poetry we're going to hear in a few moments, and it's really marvelous to think of the opportunity that she had, that she would never have had she been in the midst of tribal warfare back and forth in West Africa in the 18th century. The first great poem of Phyllis Wheatley that I'd like to take a few moments to look at here is marvelous, and came to the attention of men like Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin, deist. Ben hailed Phyllis Wheatley as great poetry. Benjamin Rush referred to Phyllis Wheatley as a great American poet. Benjamin Rush is interesting in his own right because he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was a physician for the Continental Army. He became a great advocate of the freedom of slaves and an abolitionist. He was a man who was known for helping to found the Sunday School Union in America, a Christian who wanted the Bible to be in all of our schools. In fact, he bemoaned, though he had been part of the Constitutional Convention and a great advocate of First Amendment rights, that the Congress isn't going to establish a religion, nor are they going to restrict the free exercise thereof. He wanted the Bible to be central in American schools, and bemoaned that the trend that he was seeing of the Bible not being the core of the curriculum in American schools. In fact, he went so far as wanting to have a statement over every courthouse in America that said the same into the world to seek and to save sinners, or words to that effect. He believed that there would be no civil freedom, as William Withers, as John Witherspoon, there could be no civil there was in America of the American Methodist Episcopal Church. Scientist, physician, and Christian. Miss Jefferson didn't think so much of Phyllis Wheatley's poetry. We'll have to forgive him, I guess, for that at this point. But I think there's some great iambic pentameter that we have in her poetry, and certainly great and wonderful sentiments. Listen to this one that she wrote in 1773. She's a teen poet, too, and a great encouragement to young writers. We interviewed one a couple of weeks ago on this show, the Scriptorium. Listen to what she says about coming from Africa to America. The poem is entitled On Being Brought from Africa to America. An interesting title in itself, isn't it? That alludes strongly to the providence of God in her bringing, her coming to America. 'Twas mercy brought me from my pagan land. taught my benighted soul to understand that there's a God, a Savior too. Once I redemption neither sought nor knew. Some view our sable race with scornful eye. Their color is a diabolical dye. Remember, Christians, Negroes black as Cain may be refined and join the angelic train. Now, for obvious reasons, Phyllis Wheatley didn't have any politically correct pressures being exerted on her, so she could write what would today be considered a very outside of the prescribed boxes that are being drawn for us in our society today. But she didn't have those restraints, and so she could celebrate the providence of God bringing her, even in such a horrific thing as slavery and the slave trade. Like Benjamin Rush would work so hard, tirelessly, and John Newton and William Wilberforce to end in this land Christian men. But here's Phyllis Wheatley choosing not to feature the horrors of coming as an 8-year-old child, chained in the hold of a slave ship. Unimaginable horror there, but she celebrates the providence of God in this great evil. What others intended for evil, she says, God, you intended this for my good, for my salvation. And she features and celebrates that. I don't know. I wish that I viewed the downturns, the disappointments in life, the discouragements in life. I wish I viewed them more like Phyllis Wheatley sees her being brought to this land of freedom, as she would celebrate in other poetry. She obviously shows us that there's prejudices against her. Some view our sable race with scornful eyes. She no doubt saw that, though she was brought into educated society in Boston by her family, sent off to England, all of these advantages of education and reading great literature and having time, given time, very carefully by her family to write and to read and to study. Unfortunately, not all slave children that came to America were bought and sold, had the advantages that she had. Some of them did. She recognizes that these were great advantages. Their color is a diabolical dye, alluding to the cloth trade that was also part of the slave trade, and abolitionists advocating for boycotting dyed cloth, even as they boycotted sugar and all to plant their flag in solidarity with the Africans that were being brought and sold in America at that time. And remember, Christians, she reminds those who claim to be Christians, but who don't view African Americans as equal in the church and kingdom of God. Shame on them. The Bible everywhere declares that. Ephesians 2, Psalm 87, the city of God is made up of people from Cush and Philistia and Jews and Gentiles and the wide range of races, as we have recorded by John in Revelation chapter 5, verse 9, that Jesus has purchased with his blood men from every tribe and kindred and people and tongue. We can be refined and join the angelic train, she says. Is advocating here in this great poetry. Well, she goes on, and she becomes really quite well known for a poem that she wrote, an elegy to George Field. Excuse me here for just a moment. As my computer, which went to sleep, craziness. Don't like that, but there we go. Well, George Whitefield, who a great preacher of the gospel. I was down in Savannah and got to go to Bethesda. He launched a number of orphanages, and that one is still operating there. It was marvelous to see. But he dies on September 30th in 1770. 13 voyages across the Atlantic. His patroness, Countess Huntington, Lady Huntington, their great benefactor of so many of the great awakening preachers, including Augustus Toplin and many others. The ship, even, and George Whitefield crosses the Atlantic multiple times, bringing the gospel to the American colonies. But she hears of this, the death of George Whitefield, credits him in part for her own conversion to Christ and all. And she's only 17 when she writes this poem. Hail, happy saint, on thy immortal throne. To thee complaints of grievance are unknown. We hear no more the music of thy tongue. Thy wonted auditory cease to throng. She goes on in it. Thy prayers, great saint, and thy incessant cries have pierced the bosom of thy native skies. Though thou moon hast seen, yet and ye bright stars of light have witnessed been of his requests by night. He prayed that grace in every heart might dwell. He longed America excel. He charged his youth to let the grace divine arise and in their future actions shine. And so forth she goes. Take him, ye wretched, for your only good. Take him, ye starving souls, to be your food. Ye thirsty, come to his life-giving stream. Ye preachers, take him for your joyful theme. Take him, my dear Americans, he said. The hymn being Jesus, God's Son, be your complaints in his kind bosom laid. Take him, ye Africans, he longs for you. Impartial Savior is his title due. If ye shall choose to walk in grace's road, you shall be sons and kings and priests to God. And she goes on celebrating George Whitefield's benefactress, Countess Lady Huntington. And then she writes a letter to George Washington. It's a marvelous letter. And in it, she includes a celebratory poem in iambic pentameter of Washington himself. He never publishes the poem because it would seem like he was trying to aggrandize himself. It is a very high praise of George Washington. And he received it there while he was at his headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'll just read excerpts of it here. Celestial choir enthroned in realms of light. She begins like Virgil in classical style here. She goes on, see the bright beams of heaven's revolving light involved in sorrows and the veil of night. Muse, bow, propitious, while my pen relates how poor her armies through our thousand gates. She goes on, shall I to Washington their praise recite? Enough thou knowest them in the fields of fight. Thee first in peace and honors, we demand the grace and glory of thy martial band. Fame for thy valor, for thy virtues more. Hear every tongue thy guardian aid implore. Great words about George Washington, she writes and goes on and says, and so may you, whoever dares disgrace the land of freedom's heaven-defended race. Fixed are the eyes of nations on the scales, for in their hopes Columbia's arm prevails. And then proceed, great chief, with virtue on thy side. Well, Washington greatly appreciated this poem, wrote a reply to Miss Phyllis. He entitles the letter and concludes, your obedient, humble servant, at the end, and with an invitation for her to come to his headquarters there in Cambridge. She's in Boston, just up the river from Cambridge. And by some accounts, there was a half-hour audience with His Excellency George Washington, as she referred to him. Well, a wonderful saint, Phyllis Wheatley, a great poet, And I thought I would just segue here for the final minutes of this podcast to a reading from one of my books, Guns of Providence, in which I celebrate this another great African American hero, Salem Poor. We don't know a whole lot about him. We know that he had a celebrated record fighting as a freeman in George Washington's army. I have Sandy McKeith. This is the great-grandson of Sandy McKeith of Duncan's War and Crown and Covenant there. This is the last of the Faith and Freedom trilogy. And he comes to George Washington's army. He's going to enlist. First person he meets and is taken under the wing is by Salem Poor, who'd fought heroically at Bunker Hill, who was celebrated by the officers. And they said that Salem Poor conducted himself like an officer, like a trained officer at Bunker Hill. Well, Salem Poor, man, here, I'll just put in for you in chapter four of Guns of Providence, and we'll conclude with these lines. "I wonder at his words, liberty," says Sandy McKeith about. I go up just a little bit. I want to pick up on some of these. "I'm called Sandy McKeith. I considered launching into how I was named for my great-great-grandfather, one of the best of men, but felt it might not be the right time. Sir, you was looking mighty lost there for a moment or two," he said conversationally. "You here to join up?" I swallowed. Somehow it seemed to me that how I answered the question this kind African man had posed to me was more binding than finding a pay for the recruiter. "As if you are," he continued, "I'll make things easy for you." I wondered how he could manage to do this. "I am," I said simply. "You am what?" he asked. "I'm here to join up," I said. "And just why would you want to go and do a thing like that?" he said. I felt he was testing me. "I want to fight for the defense of religious liberty in Connecticut," I said. "I want to do what I can for the cause of freedom in my country." "Now that makes you and me compatriots," he said, slapping me on the back. "Let me give you a little piece of advice," he continued conspiratorially. "Keep telling yourself that. There'll be some things that might make you despair of what you're doing, being a citizen soldier, but never forget the glorious cause of liberty." I wondered at his words, liberty? Weren't all African slaves in America? Didn't that make Salem Poor a slave? And just what did fighting for liberty mean to such a man? I wondered what things that might give me despair in my service to my country. Little did I then know how much I would need to draw upon his kind advice. "You look like you could use a cup of something to wash down the road dust," he said, pouring a reddish-brown liquid from a pot hung over a fire pit into a mug. "Drink up," he said. "My family's sworn off tea." "Foreign tea, you mean," he said. "Swear off foreign tea, but don't swear yourself off Salem Poor's balsamic Hyperion." "What is that?" I asked. "My own special blend of raspberry leaves," he said, then added in a whisper, "and some herbs and other truck I can scavenge along the way. Not the best tasting, but I do believe it keeps off the camp fever. Never tastes exactly the same one pot to the next, but I drink a pot twice a day, I do." "What's camp fever?" I asked, sipping his Hyperion. His smile disappeared. "Warm from it, more than from the fighting part. Camp's a filthy place, as you can see." He paused, stretching his arm in a complete arc of the camp, nodding knowingly as he did it. "Men die like flies from the putrid water, undercooked meat, lack of vegetables, bad living, and bad water. You got to keep clear of the bad water. Forget the bullets. It's the putrid filth that'll kill you in a camp. You got to keep your health up. And my Hyperion's just the thing." I couldn't help liking Salem Poor. And I knew at once that he was an answer to my mother's prayers for me. My father prayed that God would go before me and show me his providence in remarkable ways. Well, here was a remarkable providence. Salem Poor, 15 years my senior, more or less, it's hard to tell, became my constant companion. and I am certain that his homespun wisdom was a means of keeping me alive in those early months in Boston and beyond. Sir, he began, please call me Sandy. I'm Sandy, then, he said, his grin stretching wider still. Sandy, my friend, now here's a question for you, he said. Do you have some Indian blood in you? I said that, to my knowledge, all my blood got its start in Scotland, and more recently in Connecticut. Well, I couldn't help noticing your weaponry, he said, nodding at my bow. There's some other Indians in the camp, he added, as if in companionable effort to make me feel more at home. Without intending to, I found myself telling Sam all about my home and family, and then about my hearing problem, my dislike of the thundering of muskets, and my preference for the bow and arrow. I reckon being around muskets and cannons, he said, will balance out the extra hearing you've now got. Then you'll have normal hearing, but only for a spell. Line up for very many volley fires, and you'll be like most of the men in this here army, ringing in the ears, and pretty soon no more ringing, then not much sound at all. He meant to be kindly and reassuring with these words, but troublesome for hearing was I was loath to lose all of it. As evening came on, Salem mixed flour with water, formed it into a flat disc, and placed it near the coals. Fire cakes, we call them. No ovens for baking proper bread, but fire cakes. They'll serve. We drank more of his Hyperion as the sun glowed orange in the west, and we talked. I asked him about fighting. What was it like, and killing? He only shrugged and seemed more interested in talking about his family, left home without him, the water rising in his eyes as he spoke of them. Salem had been so kind to me that first day in camp, I wished I had something to give him in return. But I had nothing. Then a thought occurred to me. Salem, do you like music? I asked, drawing my violin out of my shoulder sack. Next thing to heaven, he replied with his grin. Playing my violin that first night in camp would prove to alter my situation as a soldier more than I could ever have foreseen. I played all the fiddle tunes I'd ever heard and stopped. Don't go and leave off playing, he begged. I ain't never heard anything so lovely in all my days. Play some more. But I don't know any more tunes, I said. The ones you just played ain't all used up, are they? He said. He lay with his arms clasped behind his head, gazing up at the heavens. Play them again. So I did. I noticed that more and more men came closer to Salem's fire as I played. Best of all, some noises seemed to soften into murmuring sounds, like the mighty Connecticut River in its wide places. I couldn't be sure if my playing had anything to do with it, but I soon forgot the noise that made me frantic when first I entered the camp. Do you know the Billings tune, Africa? He asked. I told him I wasn't so good with the names of tunes, but that if he could hum or whistle it for me, I might just be able to work it out. Hum or whistle it, he said. I'll sing it for you. He did so. With such skill and feeling, I wondered why my playing could possibly add to the music. Now shall my inward joy arise and burst into a song. Almighty love inspires my heart, and pleasure tunes my tongue. Well, we'll stop there. Thank you for tuning into the Scriptorium today, and we celebrate Martin Luther King and the great good accomplishments that he's done for freedom in America today. And Phyllis Wheatley back in her day in the 1770s. We celebrate Salem Poor and what he did fighting for freedom back in the American War for Independence. Go down there and click on follow and share the Scriptorium with us. You'll see about what's coming up on books and about guest lodging, writer's retreats as well, and about the Oxford Creative Writing Masterclass and the Armistice Tour. Thanks for tuning in, follow, and we'll see you next time on the Scriptorium.